Welcome to Walk About the Galaxy, the reunited astronomy podcast where the science is universal, the opinions are personal, and the studio is cold.
It's warmer than my studio office.
I may have been running a heater.
You're always running a heater, Josh.
We are Strange Charm Top and Down, the Astroquarks, also known as Josh Caldwell,
Addie Dove,
Jim Cooney,
and Audrey Martin.
Coming to you from the Walkabout Studio at the University of Central Florida, remember to subscribe to us on all platforms, including YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, but not Quest, Pearpop, or Halo app.
Really?
Really.
Never heard of any of this.
Pearpop?
Pearpop. P-E-A-R, pear.
Of course.
I don't know. I don't know. Or Halo app. I don't know if that's like a
British
version of WhatsApp or something.
Oh,
you can contact
really
us anytime at wtg@ucf.edu with questions, compliments,
please,
or inquiries about how to get a cool Walkabout t-shirt. Our stumper today is cosmological.
Mm. Ooh, yay.
So this is for you, Jim, welcoming you back.
Thank you.
Because I know frequently you loathe my topics.
No.
And you will loathe today's trivia.
Okay.
So just remember when we get to the trivia that the stumper was cosmological.
Okay, I appreciate that.
The stumper is simply, do you want the universe to be open, closed, or flat? Did I get my terminology correct there?
Sure.
And we'll start with you. Show them how it's done.
Actually, I
seems you're all.
No, there is only one correct answer.
Which is?
I know this is an opinion question, but there's still only one correct answer, so I'm going to wait Addie and Audrey to answer this.
All right.
I'm going to so that I can yell at them when they answer incorrectly.
Open, closed, or flat? What do you want the.
Oh, I didn't prepare for this.
I could have made the stumper just open, closed, or flat, but I'm making it more specific. What do you want the universe to be?
I did. I took a gravitational cosmology class in undergrad.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
But that was
so just a couple years ago.
Yeah. But it's what I want it to be.
What you want
so
it
technically
to be.
There isn't a wrong answer.
Oh yeah, there is.
No.
Yeah, you don't get it.
Closed.
You want the universe to be closed, which means what?
It's spherical?
It has some, I mean, that's a,
yeah.
I think that's the sort of reduced dimension analogy.
Yeah, yeah, it's spherical versus like saddle or Pringle.
Right.
Pringles.
Pringle universe.
Flat is just flat, right?
Once you pop,
Pringle, but
you can't stop.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's called saddle.
Ish.
Oh, because of the Pringle.
Yeah.
For some reason, when you said Pringle, I was thinking pretzel. And I was like, that would be
that's wrong.
That'd be a cool universe.
Could we have a pretzel universe?
Oh, yeah. I changed my answer. I want pretzel.
So a closed universe would mean that at some point the universe will contract. Is that right?
With an asterisk, yes.
With an asterisk.
Oh.
Okay. All right. Addie. I can't get your name right today.
Josh doesn't know how to say my name correctly today. It's really upsetting. It's a good thing I said my own name in the introductions.
It is.
Who knows? I think I want it to be flat, just like the Earth.
I like that answer. So a flat universe would asymptote. It would keep expanding, but slower and slower and slower and slower and slower, but never. I have simple-minded 1980s
right.
knowledge of these terms. So.
That's fine. Our understanding hasn't changed since the 1980s.
Well, the correct answer, Audrey got it.
Yay!
Yeah, excellent. Abby messed it up.
You're all saying my name correctly in my flat universe.
Yeah,
so.
It's Allie.
It's Allie. I apologize, Allie. No, it's got to be closed. Because the flat universe and the
open
universe are both infinitely large universes. And you know what we hate in physics?
Infinity.
Infinity. It's not real. It's not a thing. It's
really
just, it's a mathematical concept, but it's not a thing.
If you love infinity, you're a mathematician.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if you hate it, you're a physicist.
You're a physicist.
So that's why the universe can be divided into two things. It's like the what's her name? Jennifer Lawson book. She says, everything in the universe can be divided into two things, pandas and not pandas.
True fact.
Oh, man, that's a fun game to play.
So the open and flat are infinite.
Are infinite.
Also, what's bothering to me about them is they're infinite, but only in the one direction. In time.
In time. Yeah. I mean, they're infinite, spatially infinite, but yeah. They're not. And they are infinite in time in one direction, but not
right,
the
that's
other.
What I'm saying.
Right. I don't like.
You don't like it.
I don't like.
No likey.
No, it has to. You know, this has got to be finite. Now, we get saved from. I mean, I'm scared of the Big Crunch. Of course, everybody should be scared of the Big Crunch.
Terrified.
That's the ultimate bad news. But
every day.
These days, we're not so worried about that because we've added that extra ingredient in the universe, the dark energy. So you can still have a closed universe that still expands forever. And you're okay.
Wait a minute. Wait. What?
It like it decelerates in expansion. Right?
Accelerates.
Yeah. Oh, I thought dark energy
closed,
made it decelerate.
So usually when you say open, closed, and flat, you're referring to the geometry of the universe,
yes.
Which is intimately connected to the fate of the universe if there's no dark energy. But if there's dark energy, then you can escape the fates that you learned in the 80s.
But if it's infinitely if it's accelerating, but
diagram.
It's closed, how is it finite?
It's still finite. I mean, it's just like it's like a sphere that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but
it's finite.
But it's always getting bigger.
What?
It's still finite.
It's always getting bigger.
Yes, it's always getting bigger.
Infinitely big?
No.
No, because no matter how far you go, you're finite
it's some
distance
number.
In time, yeah.
Okay.
But it's not it's spatially finite.
I think you're tiptoeing dangerously into mathematical infinities there.
That sounds lovely.
There's an infinite number.
Tiptoeing dangerously into mathematical infinities is a great memoir.
Ooh, yes.
That does sound good.
It's not going to, wouldn't be good for my memoir.
No.
It is a good one for,
for someone.
For a mathematician. Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's an infinite number of numbers between 0 and 1.
True.
Right? But what you're describing, that one keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Well, today we'll talk about a cosmological enigma.
Another one.
A super Earth theory and the Near Earth Object Surveyor mission. But first, this episode of Walk About the Galaxy is brought to you by electricity.
Ooh.
Oh, it is.
Literally.
Harness the power of the universe with electricity. The flow of charged particles not only generates radiation from exotic astrophysical objects such as pulsars, black holes, and more, it can also be used to power your life. Available in a broad range of voltages and currents, let the movement of electrons put a bounce in your step, with applications ranging from absolutely everything to absolutely everything else. Clean, quiet, and on demand, supercharge your walk about the galaxy with electricity, movement that inspires.
Oh, I know that one.
Zumba.
No.
But I love it.
One time I was in an airport and everybody getting on my flight had been in some sort of like Zumba retreat. It was really intense.
Wow.
They all had like branded logo. I mean,
was it kind of culty?
It seemed very culty. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not Zumba.
It's not Zumba. Say it again.
Movement that inspires.
Is it Kia?
It is.
Oh.
I had a cheat code on that one.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Because I just bought one today.
Yeah.
Do we have space news? There's a Falcon Heavy due to launch imminently.
There's been so many Falcons doing things.
Right. And actually, that will be connected to our trivia.
I don't care about the Falcons, but tell me why the one that we were talking about last time, like, punked out. You're talking about
the Virgin
thing.
What happened?
The second stage engine shut down prematurely.
But they don't know why yet.
Did it fall back down?
Orbit. But not the right orbit.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
And it didn't make.
Because I remember they weren't commenting on that at first.
I think it will not be in orbit too long because it got into a really low orbit.
Oh.
So I think it will.
It went around
de-orbit.
The Earth once at least.
I think it will deorbit virally.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't think they're gonna self. I don't think they self-destruct it because
I gotta get back down into my tunnel again.
Yeah.
Like I don't think they initiated the auto destruct or anything.
Yeah.
It has an auto destruct.
Oh, yeah, those rockets mostly do. Because they're basically a missile, so you want to be able to not make it be a missile at your face.
That's smart.
Right.
Oh, man. I guess that makes total sense, but I hadn't realized that, and that's freaking amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Self-destruct is a real thing.
It's a real thing on all the rockets.
Does, if you were in that rocket, would it be like, in some female voice, be like, in 10 seconds,
it would be
this
exactly like
yep.
Yes, it would be.
Oh.
No, it wouldn't. What would be like is you would get a 30G kick in the pants as your escape motor takes you away from the rocket, which explodes without warning.
Okay.
Because as soon as it reaches that point, it happens.
That's what happened with the blue flight recently, is the capsule separated from the booster, and then the booster went boom.
Yep.
The booster might have gone boom on the ground. On its own. I think it went boom on the ground.
But it was terminated, I think. In any event,
anyway,
that's what would happen.
Another thing that happened recently that we talked a little bit about last week, that there's an update on, is that the Soyuz vehicle, I think we talked about this, that
punctured.
Is on orbit, was punctured by a micrometeoroid debris, likely. Yes. So it probably actually wasn't
not
space
orbital.
Junk. They think it was from
an actual
outside.
Meteoroid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's not micrometeoroid.
It may be not micro.
It might not be micro. It was a meteoroid.
Like small.
Debris.
Small. Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough.
But not micro.
And so they are sending an uncrewed vehicle up.
An empty one up
to bring the other people back.
An empty shuttle.
I don't know what they're going to do with the one that's up there.
The leaky Soyuz.
Yeah, I read about that too. I think what they were saying is that it wasn't that they were necessarily going to use it right away to bring people home, but they need enough seats
in case of an emergency.
Right.
And there weren't enough seats. There were like 5, but there's 11 people or something like that.
Not 11, but there's more than five.
Yeah, 11 would be a lot.
And you didn't want, like, if a mini or macro meteoroid hits the space station, it's like, time to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Right away, please.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Cool.
And then, so there's maybe going to be a Falcon Heavy launch this weekend-ish. There's some other Falcon launches.
Mm.
Artemis is, the Orion capsule is back.
Back at
Kennedy.
At Kennedy Space Center.
They took out the, little mannequins and zero gravity indicators, and they're taking all the data. Whoa. They're refurbishing the launch pad because it got a little bit more
hammered.
Blown apart than they expected. Turns out it was a really big rocket.
Which happens every time they launch a new rocket. It's always more damage at the pad than we anticipated.
Yeah. Which kind of shocks me considering how much overkill we do on so many of those things. But
yeah. But we're still about a year or maybe even over a year away from the next, from Artemis 2.
Correct.
Which will be a person-carrying mission for a sightseeing trip.
Around the moon?
Around the moon.
Around the moon.
To the moon and back.
Okay.
Yep. Cool.
That will be the farthest away a person has been in a really, really long time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Let us, since we're in the sort of lunar solar system realm, start off with also transitioning from space news to science news. The NEO Surveyor. Remind us what NEO Surveyor is.
Yeah, so NEO Surveyor is the next generation of near-Earth object detecting. There's NEOWISE, which is, I think, still operating, and it is basically we're looking for all near Earth objects,
which is what NEO stands for.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, NEO.
So these
NEO,
are
near Earth object.
These are satellites. What am I talking about?
NEO Surveyor. NEO
Surveyor.
Surveyor
can't do
will
the words.
Be.
Can't do the words.
You need
too.
A nap.
They're hard. NEO Surveyor will be in the Earth Sun Lagrange 1 point.
NEOWISE is a ground-based survey.
Okay.
NEO L1.
Right? No, NEOWISE is a spacecraft.
NEOWISE
NEOWISE is a spacecraft.
L1 is where JWST is, isn't it?
L2.
L2 is where JWST is.
Because it's on the other side. So for James Webb, it's Sun-Earth spacecraft. But for NEO Surveyor, it'll be Sun-spacecraft-Earth.
Got it.
Yeah. And it's great because, they're going to look for all of these objects that might be potentially hazardous and could impact Earth, which would be not good if we didn't know that they were coming. And so with NEO Surveyor, which is going to launch in 2028, I think, 2028, they're going to find hundreds of thousands of objects that are near to Earth that we may not have known about before, and that's really cool for defense purposes, but also you can do a lot of science with that, and you can do really cool statistical science with it because we'll have information on all of these objects.
Right. So I imagine that L1 location is critical for discovering those otherwise unseen objects, because the dangerous objects that are in orbits, and a lot of them you have to look sort of in the direction of the sun.
Yeah, exactly.
From the vantage point of the Earth to see them. But if you're off at L1, which is a fair step away from the Earth towards the sun, then you have a much better viewing angle to catch these things without having to point your telescope at the sun.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're using, it's going to look for objects in the infrared, which is cool, but it means that their instruments have to be cooled down. Cool. But they're using passive technology, so there isn't going to be a coolant on board, which could eventually run out. They're using, you know, different materials and like the geometry of the materials that I don't fully understand, but kind of in a similar way to James Webb, where it's passively cooled by the way that the spacecraft is positioned and made. And
yeah, they have lots of like radiators, and they have all these like panels to block light.
Yeah.
Does it have a refrigerator? And I'm actually seriously asking that.
I don't think so.
Okay, so passive doesn't just mean no moving parts. It really means like no energy involved.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it's really cool. So it hasn't launched yet, but it just passed a critical test with all NASA missions. There are various different tests that they have to pass along the way in order to have it, you know, launch and be successful and everything. And so they just passed a critical test, which is really exciting. And the instruments are now starting to be constructed, which is also really cool. And eventually they'll be put together and put on a spacecraft and then launched.
Neo Surveyor. Stay tuned.
Yeah. You know what I realized? We skipped right through the J-Dub corridor.
We did skip right through it with a hop, skip, and a jump.
Skip and a jump. We hit the Artemis corner, but we skipped the corridor.
Okay. Do you have some corridor?
There was this new detection of a Earth-size exoplanet.
A new detection?
A new observation of, sorry. Okay. It was first detected with TESS, I think.
The Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite.
A different survey satellite.
Right.
And it's got the fun name LHS-475B.
Fun.
Which is super fun. If you're
catchy.
A cool simulant nerd, that sounds like Lunar Highland Simulant.
It does.
But this means something else. I don't know what LHS stands for. And it's an Earth-sized planet that's probably as hot as Venus, and it's a mere 41 light years away from Earth.
Okay. And what did JWST tell us new about?
So they looked at
this planet,
LHS-475B, with near spec, which is a near infrared spectrograph, and actually got a transmission spectrum of its atmosphere.
Okay.
And they were able to draw very few conclusions from it.
Okay.
They could.
But there is an atmosphere. I mean.
So it confirmed it as a planet. This was a confirmation. So they confirmed it as a planet, and they took two transits of the exoplanet in front of its. They took several, but
they measured the spectrum of the star as the planet passes in front of it. So you get from the spectrum of the star to the spectrum of the star going through the atmosphere of the planet.
Yeah,
and then you compare those two, and you get the absorption spectrum of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Which in an ideal world tells you everything you want to know about that atmosphere. And in the real world, not yet so much.
Yeah. So they can, with the multiple transits, they can combine it and try to start looking for like specific wavelengths in the transmission spectrum as it goes on its transit in front. But this time they didn't find any molecules. There's like a graph that shows the data points, and then it's like, here's what methane would look like. Here's what water would look like.
Yeah.
Here's a flat spectrum, and they all fit.
Oh.
Well, they did say that it's likely not hydrogen rich or methane rich.
Yes.
Okay.
So they sort of eliminated those.
And I think they also said that it might be airless. Like, there is still a possibility that it could be airless.
Oh, boo.
Which would be so sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's hot. It's like, it's closer in, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it would make more
Venus
sense.
Has a whopping atmosphere,
it does.
Though.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have a hot atmosphere if the planet is, you know, beefy enough, and if this one is Earth-sized or bigger, then that hopefully would work for it. Well, cool. I mean, that's what one of the things I'm most excited about with JWST is the possibility of, like, seeing some really exciting discoveries about atmospheric composition. Although, I think that that's probably the next generation after J-Dub to actually, like, see there's really? Oxygen in an atmosphere.
Yeah. We can get some data.
Yeah. It's hard. This is, you know, it's a difficult measurement to make. Cool. JWST is continuing to
make lots of awesome observations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and function remarkably well. Let's see. Let me tell you what the trivia is, just to rip the Band-Aid off Jim's anxiety.
Perfect. Well, no, I'm nervous, too.
Yeah, you're new to our different types of trivia, Audrey. But
it's a different type.
Well, it's a category that we revisit often, uh-oh, and it's not one that Jim likes very much.
What is it?
It's about... It's
something about numbers of satellites or numbers of launches or numbers of things.
Okay. Yeah, because they were kicking off the new year here, so it's time to take a look back at 2022. So, as you can imagine, Jim, there might be several parts to this question.
I can't imagine.
But here's just the first couple, just to give you, just to get you thinking about it. How many orbital successful rocket launches to orbit were there in 2022? Okay.
From Earth?
Or Klingon? I don't know. What do you mean from Earth?
I mean, I guess I'm just thinking, like, I don't know.
Oh, like if something took off from the surface of an asteroid and to come back?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Like Osiris Rex.
No, launches.
No.
Okay.
Launches. Okay. Rocket launches from Earth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not that would change my answer, really.
I'm just hoping to get the right power of 10.
Your follow-ups will be, how many of those were SpaceX launches? And then the other questions will be about what were the top countries of origin for launches. So be thinking about that. If you're struggling mightily, I can give you some hints when we get to that. So our next...
I'm mad because I knew we were going to do this at some point and I forgot to look it up.
You could have been the hero. Yeah.
You could have nailed it.
Could have been the genius.
We all nailed it anyway.
You probably will.
Yeah. Better chance than us. Maybe me for sure. I don't know. Maybe Audrey knows.
Sticking in the planetary realm, but actually in the exoplanetary realm, so the JWST is a good transition to that.
We
Thank
took
you.
A nice corridor segue.
Thank you, Allie.
Oh my God.
Ashley is pissed now, boy.
Did you see Ashley is pissed?
Ooh. Man, I want to join in, but I can't. I've been called, like, Andrea and Ashley and Abby, so I just can't. I know how it feels.
I have never seen Maddie this mad before. So, that's not true. I've seen her this mad. Addy, thank you for the great segue to exoplanets. Trying to dig myself out of the hole now. I got a long way to go. Our exoplanet story has to do with a category of exoplanet that is very common type of planet that we see around other stars, but doesn't exist in our own solar system. These are the so-called super Earths. So they're
super
like the Earth, but bigger, basically. So they're a cup, maybe, you know, a couple to 10 times the mass of the Earth. So sub Neptunian, sub Uranus in size.
These are great just because we don't have any of those in our solar system. Mm-mm.
Right.
So yeah. It's awesome.
And it's interesting because there are a bunch of them out there.
Yeah.
Like when you look at the, you know, we have over 5,000 exoplanets discovered. And when you look at the sort of distribution, Audrey, you're talking about statistics of all those objects NEOSURVEYOR is going to see. We have statistics on planets and there's, you know, a category that we don't have an example of in our own solar system, which is kind of cool. So the question is, like, it turns out that I said they sort of like maybe 2 to 10 times the mass of the Earth. In a particular system around a particular star, you may see 2 or more of these super Earths. And it turns out that in a particular system, they all seem to be about the same. So like in system A, you would have maybe 3 super Earths that are about the same size. But in a different system, you would have maybe 3 super Earths that are a different size, but all that same size in that system.
And like similar orbital radii, like similar distributions, or how does the orbital distribution change?
The orbital distribution, I can't tell you too much about.
Okay.
So this is, you know, sort of interesting. Like each stellar system is sort of like got a cookie cutter.
Yeah.
I make super Earths like this, but a different star is making a different kind of cookie, right? Mm. But it makes that one kind.
Cool.
Snickerdoodles. Okay?
So the authors of this new study, which is Nature Astronomy, Constantine Badigan and colleagues at Caltech, have a numerical model that can potentially explain this. So we have talked before about the frost line or the snow line or the ice line, all the same thing.
I have to read this paper for my classes.
Yeah, semester. That's right. Which is the distance from a star at which, beyond which water can't exist as a solid. Sorry, beyond which water exists as can exist as a solid. So farther out, it's colder, so you get ice. And since water is abundant, then you get solid ice and you make big planets like Jupiter, right? But closer in, it's too hot and you make smaller planets like Mars. The same thing is true for silicates, sand. There's a melting or evaporation distance from a star for rocks.
It's
right?
much closer than water.
Oh, that's
much
very
closer
yeah.
in. So you have this other location. So the idea is, you know, we frequently think about star for, or planet formation in a smooth, continuous disk, you know, away around the star. But there are these two, at least, critical distances where you can have an accumulation of solid stuff. So particles drift in, have a tendency to drift in because they've got all this, there's all this gas in the disk that causes a headwind, and they drift in. And then if they're reach the high temperature, then they evaporate. So you get a pileup of solids at the ice line, icy solids, and you get a pileup of pebbles, rocks at the rock line.
And sounds so dangerous.
Then that those two locations are like sort of planet making factories.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's so cool.
So then you build your planet at the silicate line there.
Yeah.
You pop a planet out and then it does its own thing orbitally. It's going to migrate because of complicated interactions that Addie will explain. Is your name right again?
Thanks.
In her class this semester about the orbital migration of these things. And, but then you pop another one out and it's going to be about the same because it's forming in the same disk with the same general composition and that same temperatures and all of that. But if you were at a different star, it maybe has a different overall kind of disk property, so it's going to have the same process going on, but it'll make a bigger or smaller set.
Yeah,
I like
so that's
it.
The basic idea.
I like it.
So what
I like
happened
it because
in our
I can
solar
understand
system?
It.
Yeah, that makes a fair bit of sense. Where is this? Where is the sand line or whatever in our solar system?
Well, those lines move as the star and the disk evolve, right? So we have a current ice line in our solar system somewhere out there between close to Mars. But it can migrate because when you have your planet-forming disk in place, that moderates the amount of radiation coming from the star. It also can provide trapping of heat as well in the interior. So these things migrate, and that's my way of dodging answering your question.
It actually answers your question.
But
also,
it's close.
It's
it
very
is close
to the star, though.
If I mean, if a big planet like something like Jupiter ends up forming around the same time, I would imagine it would affect things, and then you wouldn't be able to get a whole bunch of the same type of planet popping out.
It's certainly going to affect the delivery of material spiraling
exactly.
Right? Because Jupiter is a big gatekeeper in our solar system.
Yeah.
And because many of the exoplanets that we see, and now moving more decisively into Josh speculating territory,
dun, dun, dun.
Are around smaller stars, I think in those super Earth systems are... You're basically seeing super Earths, but not like a Jupiter.
So maybe.
And so they're like a smaller system overall. So maybe they're not forming that big gravitational gatekeeper on the disk. And the silica line is sort of more important, perhaps, than the ice line in those systems. So that's pretty cool.
Interesting.
And it, you know, puts a new wrinkle on the sort of general picture of planet formation. So fun.
Fun.
Yeah. All right, Jim, your time.
Like, ooh. There's a fun, there's a lot, I mean, there's lots of good figures in that paper, but I really like the one, there's one that just sort of shows, like, with the mass of the disc or the ring that's available, and with the number of date, like, the periods where the things will form and how big they are, and it's just a nice little graphical way to sort of see that it makes, and it makes sense. Right. And the other, it's Batigan and Morbidelli. And Morby. And
Alessandro. Morby. Yes. Morby. I knew that, and that's why I was stumbling mm-hmm. there, who is not at Caltech.
No, he's in France.
Yeah. At the in Nice, yeah. France, yeah. Okay,
all right. Enigmas solved. We love, we love enigmas.
We love both enigmas and solving enigmas.
Solving enigmas. Yeah. So I don't know. Were you guys aware of this enigma?
Have you told us about it before?
I don't think we've talked about this
then
particular enigma
not.
On the the podcast where the Milky Way.
I know it.
Pretty big, awesome galaxy
we
that
like
we live
it.
In.
It is a good
What's your favorite galaxy?
The Milky Way. We good live answer. In the Milky Way. Yeah. But it has a handful of satellite galaxies that go along, right? Big, 10 big galaxies tend to have little satellite galaxies associated with them. Satellite galaxies might have a few million or a few tens of millions or a billion stars, something like that. Mm-hmm. The large and small Magellanic clouds are the most famous examples because they're visible to the naked eye if you live in the southern hemisphere.
Compared to like a few hundred billion for the Milky Way, right?
Right.
So, you know, much less than like 1%.
Right. Very, very small compared to the Milky Way as far as their total mass and very irregular. I mean, they're not like the cool spiral things like the Milky Way and so forth.
Not well organized distribution of stars.
So we have them, and you can actually see a bunch of those around the Andromeda Galaxy if you have cool pictures of the Andromeda Galaxy. They're there.
And
anyway.
If you're fortunate enough to live in the Southern Hemisphere or visit the Southern Hemisphere of the Earth, you can actually see the Magellanic Clouds,
right.
So I've been told.
With the naked eye. Yeah, I've never been there either. But
something you will have to explain with your long-delayed flat Earth model.
That's right. That's right.
Wow.
Man, I need to take some time off to really develop that thing.
Didn't you just take some time off?
Yeah.
Put that in your sabbatical application.
Right. There you go. But anyway, if you look at the satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, and there are about 11 of them known.
I had no idea there were that many.
There are 11. If you look at their distribution, it's actually quite peculiar. They're fairly well aligned into a disk.
Their spatial distribution around our galaxy.
Right. It's like I mean, this is much like our, you know, I mean.
Like moons around a planet.
Like moons around a planet or planets around our sun. And even their own rotational axes are reasonably well
aligned
perpendicular to their to the orbital plane, much like the planets around our sun.
Wow.
Okay.
And that is a problem.
Why?
It's an enigma.
I would think that's a good thing. Like that
sounds
would make
like a good
sense.
Thing. It does. It seems like it would, but it doesn't because
it definitely makes sense in the planetary realm, which is where we're coming
that's
from.
That's where I live.
Right.
But even in like galaxies,
but if you remember,
galaxies themselves tend to be sort of flattened down.
They do,
but stars...
clusters of galaxies shouldn't do this because the thing that flattens, you know, the physical process that flattens like the rings of Saturn or the solar system is self-interaction stuff, right? As you're rotating around, you have to have the pieces kind of colliding together kind of in a sense, and over time that flattens everything out. That process shouldn't happen in these clusters of galaxies.
There's
much more empty space. The dynamics are mostly driven by, or are supposed to be mostly driven by, the fairly spherical blob of dark matter that is the bulk of mass of our galaxy. And so that should lead to a fairly spherical distribution of orbits around the Milky Way.
Of
the satellite galaxies.
Satellite galaxies, gravitationally speaking, see the Milky Way as a sphere.
Right.
Because 80% or whatever of the matter is a spherical blob of dark matter.
That's right. That's right.
Tricky dark matter.
Dark matter. I mean, they're within this, you know, even the satellite galaxies are kind of within the overall envelope of
the dark matter.
Spherical dark matter thing. So,
our spherical dark matter envelope.
So this quest, and the reason why this is...
That's
my
memoir.
Memoir title.
The reason why this is such an enigma, it shouldn't be like that. And so that makes us question the possibility that maybe dark matter isn't really a thing, right? Maybe.
Wait a minute.
What? It has been a thorn in the side of cosmology for decades, since the 70s when we first kind of started to map out the motions of these things.
I thought we just decided that dark matter was like a normal thing that we should expect.
We're all just comfortable with it.
Yeah. And
we've
now...
finally gotten comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Well, what's the enigma?
It's okay.
Or what's the solution? Okay.
The solution is, it turns out, it's not so big a deal. So...
somebody forgot to
I was getting really
no, I mean, one of the, you know, there were a couple of problems. Like when we run simulations, we hadn't been seeing any other systems where, you know, like when you run the simulations, they don't line up like that. Well, it turns out that a couple of things. One, better observational data. The Gaia satellite is a big satellite that's measuring the positions and motions of lots and lots and lots of things in the sky, a billion or something stars in our galaxy, plus a lot of stuff that's these big bright things. So it's measuring these things. And if you more carefully look at it, and then model the motions of these things in time, they are currently in a fairly well-aligned disk, but only briefly. Only for this few hundred million years that we happen to live in.
Oh, no, this violates the thing that we always, as astronomy, in astronomy, we always
we don't
say,
like to like, be lucky.
We don't like to,
right,
be, lucky.
Don't like to be lucky, but we kind of are. Much like studiers of Saturn and their rings, right? We're lucky that we happen to live in the epoch of our solar system when Saturn has these big, bright, awesome rings.
The epoch of rings. So,
right.
We're in the planes. Epoch of
disks. Epoch of disks. And
good album title.
Yeah.
And then we also have better computer simulations. And if you look more carefully, it turns out, you know, some few percent of galaxies are going to have these things aligned as disks just because of random orientations of things. In addition, when we more carefully look these days with the Gaia satellite at the rotational orientation of those galaxies, satellite galaxies themselves, it's not as well aligned as we thought.
Well, good.
So,
okay.
Enigma solved, dark matter saved.
Enigma solved by making it go away.
Kind of making it go
away.
It's
not an explanation of the enigma. It turns out it's like, oh,
no, it's not really an enigma.
After all. Interesting. Okay, but that's interesting. Well, I did not...
That paper had some fun paper plane plots.
Paper plane plots?
They're
what's
like
a paper?
The plots of like little whizzing galaxies going around, but they're just modeled as a little like...
Oh, cute. Yeah.
...carrot arrow thing, and it looks like paper planes whizzing around to me.
Oh, I see. Awesome.
So these things are whizzing around in a more or less spherical cloud, but they happen to be kind of, at the moment, sort of aligned in our... plane.
If you let them keep going for another few hundred million years, they're going
to
be more or less spherical.
Our descendants would come to a very different conclusion.
Correct.
They wouldn't have to deal with this.
They wouldn't have to deal with the enigma. Right. Lucky,
ooh,
lucky jerks.
Them.
Yeah.
One of them is the Carina galaxy.
Who's Carina?
Well, just that's in the constellation.
It's because it's in the constellation. It's my daughter's middle name.
Fun. Which I think is awesome.
That's Sagittarius, Fornax, Leo 1, Sculptor, Leo 2, Sextans, Carina, Draco, and Ursa Minor.
You're going to have a lot more children.
And those, the LMC.
And
the SMC.
Those are, get to work.
Because those
are in those directions.
Yeah. But,
okay.
And then the LMC and the SMC.
Right.
Right. Hmm. I did not know that we had 11.
That should have been a good
galaxies.
Trivia question.
it can be in like 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks. Everybody will have forgotten.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of trivia, then,
no.
All right.
How many successful orbital rocket launches from planet Earth were there in 2022?
I really wish I'd remembered what we did a year ago.
That's what I'm saying.
I don't even know. Like,
I thought of it yesterday.
I don't have a good context.
Your first hint is that it was a record number.
It was, yeah. I knew that. I even like read an article about this like a month ago. Yeah.
Your second hint is it wasn't like double the previous record. I don't even know, though.
I have like... I'm going to say 1,000.
Okay.
I have no idea how wrong that is.
Your
Perfect.
Third hint is that Audrey really has no idea.
I'm going to say...
thank you for sacrificing yourself for the team, Audrey.
You know, I do what I can.
158.
Okay.
237.
Jim gets it.
Yes. Wow. Is there a cash prize?
180.
What?
180 successful orbital launches. That's every other day, Audrey, a rocket going into orbit. 1,000?
I feel like every day there's something going off it on the coast.
I hear you.
You know, we're talking about the whole world? Yeah. Come on.
There's only like three other places.
If I had not been on this, podcast, Audrey, I would have also guessed something like that.
You know what?
It's 40.
I'm happy with my past year's knowledge.
So that was a record number for a year.
What was it, 180?
I don't know the 180 in 2022. 2021 was not a record year, but the number, this was 44 more than in 2021. Hmm. How many of those 180 launches were SpaceX launches?
like 1,000.
You are correct.
Oh, I like it. I like it. She's sticking with it.
Do you want me to guess?
I like your guess.
I like it.
I will say 86 of those.
67.
Addy gets this one. 61.
Oh, close. Nice.
SpaceX.
I thought I was going to get that one.
I know.
A lot of those were, of course, carrying up the Starlink satellites that we've talked about many times. There are now more than 3,300 operational Starlink satellites in low Earth orbit. In the last 2 years, how many times did SpaceX have to have one of their Starlink satellites make a maneuver to avoid a potential collision?
Make a maneuver?
Yeah, they have thrusters.
Thrusters and stuff.
So they can change.
Okay, so how many times?
Do you want to know a fun fact about this? I got at least...
That we're all about fun facts here.
I got at least, I would say maybe 6 notifications.
About your satellite.
About my satellite having close approaches from other satellites. And five of them were Starlink.
Yes.
There was one that was some other
satellite. I mean, about 75% of everything in low Earth orbit is a Starlink.
And when they give you that, how close are they talking about?
Yeah. I don't know
it
how close.
Varies.
They have to make a maneuver. Okay.
No. Right. He's asking me.
I'm asking you. I just want to know,
Are they talking about a thousand? It's like on the order of 100 or tens of meters.
Oh, okay.
Hundreds of meters.
Okay. Interesting.
How many times?
16 times. No, if it was 6 for her, 200 times.
I jumped on it. I'm going to go with 15.
Audrey gets it.
Yes!
What?
Domination.
Sticking with 1,000 paid off for her 26,000 times.
Wait, what?
Oh, my God.
Can you say that again?
In a two-year period, SpaceX had to command a Starlink satellite to do a collision avoidance maneuver 26,000 times.
Is it with other Starlinks? Is it with debris? Is it with CubeSats? What?
They had to, you know.
I would hope that it's not with other Starlinks because that would indicate some poor planning on their
part.
Well,
that's true.
So,
what?
26,000 times.
26,000 times?
Yes.
How many times?
Are there people monitoring this? That's like a lot of people that have to be on that job.
I want to imagine people in an arcade playing asteroids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got this from an article in Nature. I do not know the details of how those collision avoidance maneuvers were carried out. The U.S. Had the most of those orbital launches, the 61 SpaceX plus an additional 17. What country was number 2 after the U.S. with the most orbital launches last year, and how many do you think? So there were 78 total from the U.S., 61 SpaceX, and 17 from everybody else.
India.
India.
What are we guessing?
What country had the second most?
Second most. Okay, so I got lost.
I was gonna say
China.
Oh, that's you're gonna say like China. Russia, but
say it.
I guess Russia.
China is number 2 with 62 launches. Okay. A big increase for them. Russia was number 3 with 21. Yeah. After U.S., China, and Russia is your final question. What country set its own record to come in 4th place for the year with 9 orbital launches after U.S., China, and Russia?
India. Japan.
Oh, you only get one answer, dude.
Really?
Yeah.
Who set that rule?
I did.
Where was James Webb? Where was
that? India.
That goes from...
Is it Equatorial Guinea?
I think it's French...
French Guiana.
Guiana.
I would count that as Europe.
Europe
as a country?
The European Space Agency would qualify for that with French Guiana.
Okay, I'll say Europe.
Okay.
The country of Europe.
I know.
Country of Europe.
It's
a
I'll
good American geography answer.
Go with that also.
You're going to kick yourself.
I know.
New Zealand.
Astra.
And the rocket... thing. Electron.
So they did 2?
They did. New Zealand had 9.
9?
Europe had 5.
Did India launch anything?
That's amazing.
How bad was my answer?
Yes, but fewer than 9.
Okay.
But I don't know how many.
Rocket Lab. That's the name of
Rocket Lab. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, speaking of rocket launches, we're still waiting for Starship to go. While it may have felt like I had to say that because the next thing I'm saying is, while it may have felt like waiting for Starship to launch, it was just another episode of Walkabout the Galaxy. Give us 5 stars and we'll give you the universe. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram to get all our updates and check out our website at walkabout the galaxy.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and catch up on old episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter.
At walk_the_galaxy.
And ask us questions at wtg@ucf.edu. Can't do the words today.
E-T-U.
Our theme music was composed by Richard Jerusik. Production assistance is provided by Logan Basinger. Thanks to our listeners in San Francisco and the Bay Area and around the world. Stay safe. I'm Josh Caldwell.
I'm Addie Dove.
I'm Jim Cooney.
And I'm Audrey Martin.
We're the Astrocork, signing off until the next episode of Walk About the Galaxy.